Welcome to Wisdom Personified, Conversations with Dudumsomi, a passionate and relentless pursuit of exploring how individuals use good judgment in everyday life, both in their personal and professional lives. My guest on today's episode once said, "Racial intolerance has dented our rainbow nation. Shouldn't stop us from building rainbow companies. Respect and tolerance are the keys." Ian Fur is the CEO and founder of the Hatch Institute with an extraordinary entrepreneurial career and is a seasoned keynote speaker who shares his invaluable lessons and insights on culture, self-development, leadership, customer service, and race relations. Ian's life journey has been a series of entrepreneurial ventures. Each started in a new and unfamiliar industry. He was also the founder of Sorbet Group, the largest chain of beauty salons in South Africa. Thank you so much for making the time.
Thank you very much, Didi.
What an honor to have you. Being a Sorbet customer, but that was because of you. But let's start at the beginning.
Yes.
So where were you born? Do you have siblings?
I was born in Vanderbijl Park. And people say,
can we get that reaction?
Yeah. And people say, why were you born there?
Yes, no, you had a choice.
So I said, I wanted to be close to my mother.
It helps.
That's where the milk was. So I went there to be born. I was born in Vanderbijl. I had four siblings. I had four. I've only got two left, unfortunately. Oh. And there were four boys and a girl. In fact, I was the youngest of the family, and I was there for about 4 years, and then we moved to Johannesburg. My father was one of the founding directors of Russell Furnishes, and so we moved to Joburg, and then I went into a Jewish school. They put me into a Jewish school. Not quite sure exactly why, to be honest. I was Jewish, but we were not religious. Anyway, I ended up in a Jewish school.
But good quality education, I suppose,
So the problem with being in a Jewish school is that when you are there, you're quite isolated. You don't have a lot of interaction with other people of any other religion or race or creed.
It has changed, though, has it? No,
it's still pretty much like that.
Is it? Yeah.
And the problem is when you're there, you know, it's quite easy for the powers that be to manipulate the mind a little bit, and then before you know what's going on, you think that you are chosen by God.
Are you not?
Definitely not.
Yeah.
But the thing is, when you're young and naive, you can easily believe that.
Yeah.
And so that's why I left school and believing that, and then I went into the army I was quite challenged by that because for the first time in my life I met another group of people, white, Afrikaans-speaking, Christian, males.
Who are also chosen.
They were also chosen. they were chosen too. And so I came in thinking that I was chosen, and I can tell you for sure they didn't agree with that. And then they told me they were chosen, exactly what you're saying. And that was quite hard for me because it was kind of a dilemma, you know. Like, who's doing the choosing here? And why is he so confused?
Yeah.
So I realized, I suppose that was my first realization about superiority and inferiority, and that there's no such thing as a chosen people.
Have you met any all African just different people that said, we're the chosen ones?
Not yet. Not yet, but I'm waiting.
We usually say we're the first human. Yeah?
Right.
Humans.
Okay.
That every nation comes from us.
Yes.
You've heard that, right?
I've heard that. Yeah, I've heard that before.
So your surname is Fur.
Fur, yeah.
Yeah. What heritage is it? And it's really not a common surname in South Africa.
No, not at all. It's a German surname.
Mm-hmm.
It used to have the two little umlauten on the U.
Ah,
the two dots on the U.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which meant that you had to pronounce it Fuhr. But because we were Jewish, my father didn't like it. He said it was too close to Fuhrer.
Mm.
And so we changed it to Fuhr at that stage. But In fact, my grandparents come from Lithuania.
Okay.
Yeah. They lived there just before the war. Yeah.
Do you still have relations there?
Not that we're aware of.
Yeah.
No.
Interesting. I haven't heard about
Lithuania
in a while. Yeah. In a while. Yeah. Before it was quite top of mind. From each of your parents, what is the one wisdom that you took from them and how it shaped the character that you are?
Okay, my father was, I think he was quite fanatical about customer service at Russell's, and I think I learned a lot about customer service from him.
Did you used to go into the shop?
Not really, I was a bit young.
Yeah?
But he used to come and tell stories at the dinner table. In fact, the whole family was involved in business in one way or another, so I've probably learned a lot at the dinner table.
That's a learning other races are trying to get from the Jewish
nation. And that was the privilege.
Yeah. That you discuss business around the table.
Correct.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was it. And then my mother, she was more loving and just wanted me to be proud of myself. And she said, a pat on the back always pushes out the chest.
So she said, is so visual,
you
actually.
You must recognize the achievements of people, and you must pat them on the back, it'll push out their chest.
I love it. I'm going to use that. Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Nice.
What were your pastimes as a child before your teen years?
I used to play a lot of sport. Yeah, I played soccer and cricket at primary school and at high school. And then in high school, I became a chess player.
Mind was forming.
This circumstantial... this one guy was in my class, he was the South African junior chess champion at the time. And so he taught me how to play, and I played a lot with him, and then I became a reasonable chess player.
Wow.
Yeah, so I still enjoy playing chess. It's good for the mind. It should be, I think it should be compulsory in schools.
Yes, in schools, shouldn't it?
Definitely. It's really good.
That will be something. Uh-huh. Department of Education. So when you think about your early years, having started your business at 25...
And 22, actually.
Really?
Yeah, sorry, 22.
Yeah, so reflecting on the environment you grew up in and the people around you, how do you think that facilitated your mindset for business?
Well, it was really my older brother that actually initiated that because he came back from the States and he said he had seen this business called Kmart in America.
Yeah.
He said, we need to open a Kmart in South Africa. And in the meantime, I had very successfully dropped out of university after trying to do a BCom, so I dropped out in my second year and I was doing nothing. He said, why don't we open a Kmart in South Africa? Aim it at the black market.
Yeah.
It was his thing. He said, there's nobody doing anything like that in these large departmental discount stores. And I said, well, which one of us is we? and he said, you, because he had a job already and I had to go out and I was young and naive and a bit stupid, so I didn't really know. And I said, sure, let's do this. Sounds like fun.
It usually works when you're naive.
Very naive. And my naivety actually came through a little bit more when we started the business because we just used their name. I didn't know anything about trademarks at the time. Really, really very, very naive. And then to make matters worse, we used their logo as well.
So my background is advertising,
really
so I'm like, oh my gosh, did you just do that?
So 12 years later, that would come back to haunt us, but that's another story altogether. Then we had to change our name. So we started Kmart in South Africa, the first Kmart in 1976. I was 22, almost 23 years old.
Wow.
And I was thrown in the deep end, really. I mean, seriously, in the deep end. It was the first time I'd ever had any interaction with black people of any significance.
Wow.
All the customers were black. The entire staff was black. And there I was, this lone, young, white boy that knew nothing, particularly when it came to communicating with black people. So I was really, I was challenged. And then I had to find somebody to help me. So one of the guys I found was a guy called Ralph Mamela. He was one of our supervisors, and I asked him, please help me to try and understand how best to communicate with my people and all of this.
It's amazing that you even thought about that, because some businesses seem to think,
Yeah, they just wing it.
Yeah. We'll come to the party regardless of what they say.
That's right. Subservience is easy. Mm. Yeah. Yeah, but so I was a bit stuck and I asked him, and it was going okay. He was helping me a bit. And then one day, it was in the middle of the consumer boycotts towards the end of the 70s. And in those days, they were handing out pamphlets in the streets promoting a boycott of white-owned stores. And of course, we were a white-owned store. And then one day, one of the staff runs in and says, "Ralph, my man, my mentor, is out in the streets handing out pamphlets promoting a boycott of our own store."
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so then I felt was a bit of a betrayal. And so I called him in and I really dumped on him and shouted at him, "How could you do this, you know, after all I've done for you?" It's a typical white comment, mm-hmm. you know. And he said to me, you know, he said, "Thanks very much for employing me. I enjoy my work and I enjoy trying to mentor you." He said, "But I need to tell you that every single day, we come into work and we're harassed by the police in some way or another, either me or my friends or my family, and we are suffering." He said, "And we're suffering badly here." So I said, "Okay, I didn't know it was that bad." And he said, "For me, it's freedom first and work second." And I thought, wow, that was a big eye-opener for me. And I said, "Okay," instead of firing him, which was the plan, I then said to him, "Okay, now I need a proper mentor. Now you've got to take me and show me exactly what's going on in this country.
For me to really understand."
And that was the beginning of my racial healing journey.
Yeah.
Yeah, of my education.
In recovery.
I'm still in recovery.
It's a lifelong journey.
Lifelong journey.
It is.
And more to come.
Yeah. So you have launched 5 successful companies in new industries, challenging prevailing conditions. What in your spirit knew you could launch these companies and succeed?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I think what made me go into different companies, and not just different companies, different industries each time, a completely different industry. And people often ask me that question, "Why didn't you just stick with your knitting? I was in retailing and stick with that." But things happen, you know, circumstances. I met Kaifa Semenya and Leto Mbulu in Zimbabwe. I was taken up there. And so I went into the music industry, and I distributed their music. And then Hugh Masekela came, and we sold the Soul Brothers and a whole lot of other big artists. So that was the one thing. And then afterwards I realized, you know, moving into a new industry, it's interesting because you come in with fresh eyes.
Yeah.
And you're not contaminated by the conventional wisdom of that industry. Because people say, this works, this doesn't work. And I said, no, I'll find out for myself.
With fresh eyes.
With fresh
eyes. This is what the value of diversity is.
Exactly.
Which our country boards are also not getting.
That's correct.
Fresh eyes.
Fresh eyes.
From a different industry. Because we want you to have a track record in the industry.
Absolutely. How many years have you been doing this? And they love it when you say you've got 20 years of experience.
Doing the same
thing. But the problem, I think, it's just 1 year of experience repeated 20 times. And so there's a challenge.
So do you call that bravery in yourself?
Stupidity, man. I think I tell you what it is. I think it's a kind of a naive confidence that if it doesn't go well, it's okay, you'll start again and carry on. Yeah.
It's not the end of the world.
It's not the end of the world,
I suppose it's that whole thing of the freedom of your spirit versus being imprisoned by money.
Yes.
You know, I was thinking
exactly
Ralph's thing about freedom first
and work second.
Work second.
Yes. Yes.
So reflecting on your upbringing, how do you think it shaped your early self-assurance and appetite for risk? Because I know you say stupidity, but there has to be something more to it. Because many of us are quite naive at young ages and we don't do that.
In fact, my self-confidence was a little weak at that stage because I had grown up with a bit of a speech impediment. I used to stutter quite badly.
Mm.
Yeah, and so that sort of diminished my self-confidence quite a lot. So I could never say I was highly confident, but I think in terms of business and understanding, there were a few things that I really put my mind to. The one was race. I was really interested and fascinated by race and the impact that race had on culture. So I became a bit of a, you know, like a culture guy.
and expert to ask.
And also the relationship in terms of race and culture, which particularly in the apartheid days was a massive thing. So I started to realize that if I needed to build a culture, I needed to understand race and to try and see how we could make people feel comfortable and have a sense of belonging in the workplace. And so that was part of the journey.
Yeah. Do you ever kind of venture into the class issues?
Yes, we do. I think that's a natural thing that everybody looks at the moment, but particularly now with the old laws gone, now it becomes more of a class issue. But I still believe that race is a major factor in South Africa and virtually touches everything in one way or another.
Because sometimes I think, especially being an African person, the assumption that we are monolith sometimes is an issue. That there are actually class structures.
And privilege and issues as well.
Having started in advertising, I remember one ad, which the brand I shall protect, but they had a different execution for the white market and a different execution for the black market.
Yes.
The white market is very romantic in the bath and blah, blah, blah. And I don't know what the scene for the black market was. And so the person who was giving us feedback was saying, well, they asked whether it was somebody domestic or whatever, and the view was that, their partners don't see them bathing. So I said, well, if you're bathing in a dish, it's not really romantic.
Romantic.
However, if you go to a middle-class home and there's a bath, it's a totally different story.
Exactly.
And I just was shocked.
I remember
shocked.
Those metal tubs that people used to bath.
So I was just like shocked that they couldn't ascertain that there's a different lifestyle and class thing.
Indeed.
So it's always something that fascinates me.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean that one is better than the other. It's just different experience.
Exactly.
Have you ever had to choose between professional success and personal joy, and how did you navigate it? If not, do you have a perspective for someone who is in such a predicament? Yeah. And I'm not asking for myself.
It's finding the balance, I think, is probably the answer. But the thing is, I've been searching for the balance for nearly 50 years now, and I haven't found it yet. So I think if you love what you do, there's a bit of a grey area there. There's a bit of a grey area because it kind of overlaps your work and your life, your social life and your work starts to overlap, and it becomes something that you enjoy doing at work, so then it should be part of your life.
Yeah, it's integrated, really.
Integrated, and that's why I'm still working today at 72. I don't think I can retire. I retired for an afternoon nap. after I sold Sorbet, and then carried on. I think I'm working just as hard now as I ever have. So I only want to die when I'm dead.
Do it for real.
I don't want to die while I'm still living and stop working and stop being stimulated. And you know, there's much still to do. Particularly in this country.
Yeah. But I mean, it's just such a joy to be able to do stuff because you want to, not because you have to.
Exactly.
It is a gift that people really...
And I suppose I've been very fortunate with that over my life.
Yeah. Can you briefly share the essence of your business philosophy, regardless of the industries you are in? How did that philosophy originate that you...
Okay, so that was part of the culture, and I think the most important thing there is that the purpose of work, you know, is to serve the needs and wants of your customers, and if you serve them well, you'll make money. So most people think that it's just about making money.
Yeah.
They come to work to make money.
Mm-hmm.
And we ship that paradigm and we say to them, no, you come to work to serve. And that's what I trained all those people at Sorbet.
Yeah.
Because I did the induction training for every one of them that ever joined that
business.
And
they're still living. The ones that were trained by you are still living it.
Pleased to hear that. So that was the thing, is that the purpose of work is to serve. So it's a big paradigm shift for most people, and it takes them a while to get their heads around it, because we are so fixated on making money and having salary and feeding our families, which of course is critical, but you can't do that effectively unless you've served well.
Yeah.
So if you serve first, service always before reward was my philosophy. Yeah. And of course then having a culture which then lays the platform for that service.
Yeah.
Where people have a sense of belonging, where they feel trusted and respected, where they feel that they are treated fairly and equally and with dignity,
yeah.
And that their contributions are valued, their voices are heard, all of those things.
Yeah. And you captured a lot of it in the...
That's all in the culture nearing book.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah, all of that is there. So that was the framework, the culture framework that I had developed over the years through all the different companies and then applied that at Sorbet. And I think the interesting thing about the start of Sorbet was I didn't really know anything about the beauty industry. In fact, less than zero.
So I always say that
I thought a Brazilian was a person who lived in Brazil.
Still is, still but... Is.
And that Hollywood was a place they made movies. You know? So I...
Had to learn a lot.
Yeah, I knew nothing, but the opportunity was there to start with my new culture framework, or in fact the old one, but it had been continuously revised, and see if that framework could work in a new business.
Yeah.
And that's how Sorbet started. So it was about the opportunity to test my philosophy on culture rather than my knowledge and desire to be in the beauty industry.
Yeah. I must say that is such an amazing place to be. I mean, I have a strategic advisory firm with Sorbet Leadership Partners, and my thing was also just to try some stuff. My philosophers and
fantastic.
See if they work, you know.
Yeah,
it's a privilege my parents didn't have.
Yes.
Even though, you know, they enjoyed what they did. But, you know, to be in that space to experiment, it's great.
Right.
But yours worked big time.
Yeah.
So why do you think it's important to hire, you did talk about Ralph.
Right.
To deepen your understanding on how to reach the black market when you launched in South Africa.
Hmm.
Because, as we were mentioning earlier, businesses do that. They don't go through the process you went through. Why bother?
Yeah. I think it's a big thing for me. You know, in fact, when I started Sorbet, I was invited to one of the parties of a product supplier. And it was about a new launch of a new product, and I had just started there. I was really naive in terms of the business and beauty. And then I walked in there, and I was the only guy there, and I was, at the time that I started Sorbet, I was 51 already. And they thought, here's this old white guy, what is he looking for here? It looked very suspiciously at me. Perhaps they thought I was some kind of a trafficker or something. So they kept a wide berth from me. But the interesting thing was that all the people that were there, the staff of the company, and also all the salons and the salon owners and all their staff, were virtually all white. And and this was 2004, and I was really surprised by that because I'd been working with black people all my life. And so I went up to them and I said, you know, we are the black people.
Mm.
I said, no, there's very few black people that do skincare. You know,
really?
They do nails, but very few that do skincare. So I said, what do you mean? No. He said, no, you know, this particular product is an upmarket product. It's expensive.
Mm-hmm.
It's bought mainly by white people who prefer to have white therapists working on their skin. So, I was shocked to hear that. And I said, are you serious? And she said, yeah, that's the way it is. So I thought to myself at the time, I didn't say anything. I didn't want to make a scene right there, particularly as I was so new in the industry. But I thought to myself, we need to change this thing.
Yeah.
And I must say, looking back, it's probably the thing that I'm most proud of at Sorbet was that we literally changed the face of the beauty industry.
And just like that. And it did. Because even the therapists, as I said, at one time I did consider it as a franchise.
Yeah, yes.
And that's the one thing that they said, that they never found space before and you gave them the opportunity because it was latent talent.
Yeah.
They just didn't have the avenue to get in.
Didn't have the access, yeah.
You know, that's why I'm just fascinated by your interest in understanding the market instead of imposing your ideas. Because just because something is not happening doesn't mean it's, you know, I mean, I've been doing facials all my life.
Exactly,
What wisdom have you learned about expanding business outside of the South African market following the failure of Sobe in Britain? Did you have a British mentor?
No. And that would have been, I think, a much better plan.
Uh-huh.
The whole UK thing was a disaster for us and for me in particular, because I think there was a degree of arrogance there on my part that you know, if you've been successful in one market, you can just automatically go out there
and replicate
and
that
the
successes.
UK has been waiting for you, you know.
Yes.
They need you.
Yeah. And, it's like, where have you been?
Yeah, so we just kind of translated what we had here straight there.
Yeah.
We didn't have enough knowledge of the market. We didn't really know what they wanted. So it was a blunder of note. But the one interesting thing that wasn't really our fault, besides the arrogance and the mistakes and all that, was that the quality of the therapist there, you know, was nowhere near our quality here. That was a big shock to me, a big surprise.
There are a whole lot of things that I think people should, like hospitality in general.
Yes.
In South Africa.
They didn't have, and there were very few British people, you know. There were people from every country in the world living in London.
Yeah.
And each one came with their own education in terms of beauty therapy. That was a nightmare.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was a big lesson, and I think the biggest lesson is not to do it again. try and avoid that like the plague until you understand exactly what's going on in that market. And I think a lot of South African companies have made that mistake over the years.
Yeah, different ones in different countries, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So we usually get quite excited about opportunities and gaps in markets.
Yeah.
How do you propose we go about thinking and finding out whether there is a market in the gap?
Yeah, market in the gap. I think it's just about research and finding out and taking the time to go out there and ask people and see what's going on. You know, we just assumed. You make a big assumption and, you know, that was useless. So you need to go out there and do your research and get people to you know, ask them and do these questionnaires and whatever else you can do, just to get a feel for what they want.
Yeah.
You know, we just assumed the look and feel of Sorbe, which was so well accepted here, would be perfect there. But no, they wanted a more homely type of atmosphere where you could sit on the couch and wait and relax. And Sorbe was far too clinical. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was far too, looked like a pharmacy to them.
Yeah.
Not like a beauty salon. Yeah. And there was too much retail. They thought they were in a shop and not a beauty salon. So lots of lessons to be learned.
I mean, before we started, as I was saying, that the minute it changed from the boutique therapist that I used to to Sorbe, because I'm also that kind of person. Like, you know, so I knew that Sorbe for me will be for my nails and feet, but for my massages and facials, I'll have to go elsewhere. So maybe the UK market could also do the same thing.
That was the sentiment of a lot of people.
Yeah.
So like in the beginning, we were focused on facials and stuff and massages and that, and nails was a relatively small portion of our business. But over time, that morphed itself. It wasn't intentional. It just morphed itself, and people became fixated on nails. And I could never understand what the thing was about nails, you know.
Because you see,
why women
them
are
so
obsessed
often.
With nails? I couldn't believe it.
And they go often.
Yeah,
like
they go
twice
often.
A month sometimes.
And it's not to impress men.
No, it's just for their own.
Men don't care about it. No. You know, I've never seen a bunch of guys standing around a bra. You know, and then this attractive woman walks past, and they say, "Gee, man, did you see that beautiful set of nails?"
You see, we do things for ourselves.
Yeah.
It's not always for the men. it is because that even during a slump,
yeah,
it's one that seems to maintain.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
They'll just always have their nails done. Rather that than eat, or rather than movies or anything else.
Yeah,
the nails. Yeah. Gotta have your nails done.
Because we're very self-conscious. If it's not done, you keep on doing that.
Yeah.
But anyway. Okay. So in 2020, you founded the Hatch Institute.
Yeah.
What does it do?
So that practice, you know, in fact, it practices the cultureneering framework that we developed over the years. Because it worked so well at Sorbet, then I decided to go and try and, you know, consult and coach on that philosophy in other companies, and I must say that's been going very well.
Yeah.
You know, companies large and small, and they're picking up on this, and they feel it works.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you need that, because usually it's either we have a toxic culture or we have disengaged employees.
So if you work on that. So that's the common theme. And then we do the audits, the culture audits.
Yeah.
We start with that. And then we do individual coaching of the execs. And then we run workshops to get people to understand the philosophy and that the purpose of work is to serve.
Yeah.
All of that stuff. And yeah, so it's been going well. And then, of course, we bring the racial healing stuff in there
as well.
Because it's part of the culture.
Mm,
yeah.
We'll talk about the book just now.
Yeah.
What do you think the biggest obstacle to productivity in the South African workplace is today in contrast to pre-1994? And what do you think is the lowest hanging fruit you could recommend in changing these conditions?
Yeah, I think that's a big question. As far as I'm concerned, I still think race is the issue. You know, I've just had so much experience of it with coaching people and sort of digging into these things and questionnaires and audits and surveys in companies. It always comes out as a problem. And psychological safety. So the damage that has been created by 350 years of systemic racism has created a lot of psychological damage where people still feel that there's inferiority and superiority, and it lingers on, and it's not really addressed properly in the workplace. They have culture audits, and they have diversity workshops, and the diversity workshops are good.
Once off, though.
Yeah, it's once off, and it doesn't dig into the real thing. You know, it's kind of superficial to a large degree. You don't get into the psychology of racism and the impact that that
had. Forward.
Yes.
How then do you
indeed
transform your leadership style to accommodate all these races?
So we run these racial healing circles, and we do them at Constitution Hill. We run a two-day workshop there, and we take them on a tour, and then we spend the rest of the time there in this group, and, you know, talking to each other, telling stories, and getting to understand why people think the way they do and why they behave the way they do. And it's a big eye-opener for a lot of people.
Isn't it scary that 31 years on,
that
a lot of conversation is still not happening?
Yeah.
Like, you have these races under one roof, and they still don't talk.
Yeah, they don't talk.
Like, they don't have friends from another race group when they leave the office. That's it.
And there's a lot of ignorance as well, you know, in terms of the real history of South Africa, particularly white people. They have very little idea what actually happened, what apartheid was, what was the underlying reasoning and the thinking and the objective of apartheid and all of these things. And when you actually expose them to this, they say, I didn't know. So it was like a mystery to a lot of these people. And they say, you know, I'm not a racist, I don't see color, and all of that stuff, you know, which is just a big blind spot there.
Yeah.
And they think that that's a good thing.
Yeah.
And then, of course, a black person listening to that says, you know, how can you not see my color?
No wonder you don't accept me as I am.
Exactly. I mean, how can you not see my color? My whole life has been determined by my color, and you're telling me you don't even see it?
Yeah.
And so there are lots of things like that that go on in these workshops.
Yeah. I mean, we used to have, I did my MBA at Gibbs.
Right.
So we decided to have lunchtime discussions, our group.
Yes.
Amazing class of 2005 and 2006.
Right.
So, and we used to just have discussions. And I remember one individual not understanding why we have employment equity, and it was exactly that.
Exactly,
he
yeah.
did not understand how education was so segregated.
Yes.
So he just thought 1994, we're all running, and yeah. we should all be keeping up.
Yes.
So it's amazing.
And everything is fine now.
Like, everything is fine.
We can, yeah.
yeah. I must say, not to try and overtake the whole thing, I had one unpleasant discussion with Mark Shuttleworth years ago when I met him, and he couldn't understand that either in terms of merit. And I was like, even though I went to a private school, you as a white male, I'm still, even though we both went to the same school,
yeah.
whenever you people see me, they still think affirmative action
yeah.
means inferior,
yes.
even though I have the same education,
right.
same skills.
Yeah.
So the whole yeah. thing of merit,
yeah.
yeah.
It's a big factor.
Anyway, but so we're talking about your latest book. I didn't know until you told me about it, so thank
right.
you for making me aware.
Yeah.
So it's called The Human Bridge,
yeah.
Racial Healing in South Africa.
Yeah.
You published it in 2024.
Yes, and it was co-written with Nina de Klerk.
That name looks familiar to
yes,
me.
Yes, yeah. She's the sister-in-law
yeah.
of FW.
Okay,
yeah,
okay.
She was married to his brother.
Oh.
A guy called Wimpy de Klerk. You might
okay.
have heard that name.
Yes,
yes.
I have.
Yes.
I thought we also had somebody in my advertising days who I thought was the prince. Anyway, you are an author also
yeah.
of other books, which is Get That Feeling.
Yeah.
And then The Soul of Sobe, and then Cultioneering, which you
right.
just had. So why was it important now to write this book again?
Yeah, that's a big question again. So I was sitting in a conference which was being run by News 24.
Yeah.
Yeah. This was in 2023. And they were talking about the future of South Africa. It was before the elections, and they had all the opposition politicians there, and occasionally there was lots of very interesting discussion. And I'm sitting in the audience just as a participant, and I'm waiting for them to talk about race, and just, you know, I couldn't believe that you could talk about the future of South Africa without mentioning race once. Nothing.
And they didn't. Because everybody's polite about it.
Yeah, they didn't mention it once. And there, while I was sitting in that audience, I decided to write this book.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I thought, no, we've got to actually do something about racial healing, because it's such a big topic that no, it was like falling off the radar.
Yeah. I think because we have a black government,
yeah.
everybody thinks everything is okay. You know?
Yeah.
And yet we also have to look at part of what's happening is because the African people themselves haven't healed.
Yeah.
Which is why we are embarking on such destructive ways, because that's why money is everything. And we have forgotten what the freedom was about. Well, thank you for that and the work that you're still doing.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how have your family and friendships shaped your business decisions?
Well, I was highly influenced by my family.
And friends?
Friends, not so much now. It was mainly
really?
Family, because I went into business with my brother.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But in terms of...
in the beginning.
Is your so-called mainly business people or...
Now it is, yeah.
Is
but,
it?
But in the early days, it wasn't so much.
Yeah.
Because most of my friends were studying... you know, for degrees, and I had left university,
yeah.
and I was busy working in a shop in town, and so I don't think I was influenced much by my friends, but my family, my older brothers were very influential,
mm.
and my father.
In terms of the creative in arts and stuff, are you into that as well?
Well, I ran a music company for
yeah.
for 7 years, so yes, I was always interested in music. And you know, in fact, I used to play guitar. I was a semi-professional singer.
Yeah,
I used to sing in a ladies' bar in the place called the Crest Hotel in Berea.
Okay.
Back in the day.
Yeah.
1970 something.
yeah. Is there one decision you wish you had never made in life, and why?
From a business perspective,
just any.
Yeah, anything. Yeah. I'd say from a business perspective, it was probably the journey to the UK was a big mistake, which I would have liked to have avoided if I could. Yeah, I think that's probably the biggest one, yeah.
I want your life.
It's not all wine and roses, yeah. I could do.
So many leaders are grappling with how to use their platform to open doors for others. What has that looked like in your own leadership journey?
Yeah, I think all of the businesses that I've been involved with was always to create space for people to have opportunities to grow. So my sort of general life philosophy was to make a contribution to the lives of other people. That's really what I've always believed. So the money was like the reward, and it was nice, but it was the purpose that drove me and still drives me today. Mm.
I do. I'm kind of trying to think before you're born,
right,
what kind of contract you had, because you seem to be very single focused, which is great to have found your way in life quite early, and it's still continuing.
Yeah, that's been a mission, you know, and a journey, but it's been reflected and executed in different ways throughout the different businesses,
yeah,
and in my home life. You know, with my children, you know, also believing in the same philosophies and practicing these things.
Yeah. Yeah. If I had to ask your family to describe you in three words, what would they say?
Oh, dear, that's a tough one.
Yeah.
I would say loving father.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, they were with me at Sorbet, all three of them. And they were playing major roles, you know. So I think sometimes I get a little bit too much credit for what happened at Sorbet. They did
wow.
They did a fantastic job. My daughter built the brand, not me. She built it. The one daughter, and the other daughter helped the franchisees. And my son was operations. He ran the store. So we had it was proper family business.
Yeah.
My niece and my daughter-in-law. We were all there.
And they've evolved into other businesses?
And we all left at the same time, more or less. Corporate life, you know, we were bought by Brian Joffe, mm-hmm, and Long for Life.
Yeah.
And that 1 year of corporate life definitely wasn't for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You need your freedom, I can see.
No. That wasn't great.
How has your definition of success evolved with each new venture? And what does it look like to you now?
Success, you know, can be defined for me, in fact I was saying this earlier on, can be defined for me as the contribution you make to other people's lives. And I think that's how I judge myself. So if I've made a good contribution and other people have been able to benefit from the platform that I've created, that's the purpose.
Yeah.
Of life. You know, and also this thing that there's always more to do. There's always more to do. You know, there's this author, Viktor Frankl, who was involved in the Holocaust.
Yes.
And I read that book, and somebody asked him, how did you manage to survive when all the others around you were giving up and dying? And he just said, well, there was much still to do.
Mm.
And he did. And then he wrote that world-famous book called Man's Search for Meaning.
Mm. Yeah.
And so I've adopted that thing from him, and I always say there's much still to do.
Yeah, and when you're going through a hard time, to say this too, this too shall pass. You just have to
same thing, exactly.
Survive through it. What habits or personal disciplines have you that have helped to help you stay grounded while you are building all these businesses?
I think two things mainly. Firstly, I wake up very early in the morning, which was never part of the plan, but it just is that. So I start working every day at about 4:30 in the morning.
And you sleep at what time?
I get to sleep at about 10, between 10 and 11.
Mm-hmm.
And then the best work is done in the first 3-4 hours of the morning. So when most people are waking up, I've already had half a day's work and been able to do things well. Because once I get into the workplace, then it's a different thing and I'm either coaching or whatever. But my whole life I've been like that. So I do all the work in the morning. So that's one habit that I will continue to do as long as I'm able and healthy. And then the other thing is I've always tried to, you know, to find time to spend in the bush. I'm a huge wildlife lover, and my whole family has been for many years. So we always try and go as often as we can. My oldest brother, who was with me in the beginning at Kmart.
Yeah.
He had a camp up in Botswana next to the Okavango Delta there, and we used to spend a lot of time there. That was paradise on earth.
Imagine.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, I'm already there.
Yeah, lovely. Okay.
And in terms of two rituals that you hold dear as a human being that makes your relationships healthy and strong.
Yeah. I think always to focus on other people. You know, if you focus on yourself all the time, then you become a legend in your own mind. And so I've always tried to show, you know, interest in what other people are doing. And I think that's one of the traits that I would like to carry on and show interest in people. And then the other things, you know, just the continuous learning curve, reading, listening, meeting people. I'm busy now with Amnesty International. They're interested in working with this human bridge thing. So just meeting new people and learning from them, basically. My learning journey started in 1976, and next year will be 50 years, and I'm still learning.
When are we doing to celebrate?
Good question.
Something to think about.
I'll think about that, yeah.
Well, I could speak to you forever, hey. And thank you so much for your impact, because I love your impact.
As knows.
Yeah.
They're looking good.
Thank you. Somebody butchered them, and we just said, okay, let's keep them short for a while. It wasn't a sorbet, it was somewhere else.
Sure.
To end our conversation, any final wisdom that you want to share that we haven't covered so far?
I think particularly being an entrepreneur, I've kind of worked out over the years that there are four main characteristics of an entrepreneur. The one is that you need intuition. Intuition is, in my view, is the belief that something is right, even though you don't have the evidence to prove it. So it's like a gut feel, and you must believe it. So if you look at sorbet, it took me 4.5 years to break even in that business. So it wasn't an overnight success by a long shot. But I just believed that it was right, and we had to keep going. The second thing is you can't be afraid to fail. You know, as an entrepreneur, if you want to be successful, you can't be afraid, because if you are afraid, you're not going to do half of the things that you should be doing. You're not going to be bold enough to make those calls. And then, of course, courage—the courage to continue when things are looking bleak, and they're often looking bleak. And then finally, the determination for the long haul, because nothing happens overnight, you know. Entrepreneurs are a bit like pioneers. You get pioneers and you get settlers. The pioneers are the ones that go out into the unknown territory without a map. And they make their own map. And they have to face all the dangers, unknown dangers that come along their way. And then the settlers wait on the mountaintops overlooking and say, is it safe out there now?
That's an interesting one. I never thought about it that way.
And then, yeah, and they say, no, it's never safe, but at least we're here and we can sell you a map, actually, because we've created the pathway for you to follow. And that's the difference between the pioneer and the settler.
I love that wisdom. Thank you. What a perfect way to end our conversation.
It's a pleasure.
And thank you for the privilege.
Thank you for the privilege of being interviewed by you.
Thank you. Ian, on behalf of the many who are conscious and the many who may never know the positive impact you have had and continue to have in our country, thank you for the human being you are. Aside from the business success you have enjoyed, your humanity and training still resonates in the exceptional client service of the therapists you trained in sorbet long after the change in ownership. I know many that have gone on to be entrepreneurs themselves. Here we are, folks. I hope you are so inspired to make a conscious and positive impact in every space you occupy, regardless of your title and position. Like, share, and subscribe. Until we connect on the next episode of Wisdom Personified, Conversations with Dudumswamy. Be compassionate, love-filled, and live consciously. Thank you for listening to this episode of Wisdom Personified, Conversations with Dudumsomi. Please also like, follow, and subscribe to our channel and share the wisdom with your friends. I would love it if you could rate and review as well. Wisdom Personified, Conversations with Dudumsomi is also available on YouTube, Facebook Watch, Apple, and Google Podcasts, as well as Spotify. Enjoy the wisdom journey.